Okay, so now we're going to continue with the four Satipatthanas, the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and the second set of these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas. And we're going to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, which is one way of looking at these Satipatthanas. And in, as far as I can see, it is the main way of practicing Satipatthana in the suttas is Anapanasati, because it is the only thing that is said to fulfill the Satipatthana meditation. So I would consider it the main way, and also because it is was practiced by the Buddha on his way to awakening, and it is a very common thing found in the suttas. That's how I understand it. It is probably not the only way. There are other ways probably to do it as well. But it is certainly important. So this is found in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. And it's called the Anapanasati. Anapanasati just means in-breath and out, mindfulness of in-breathing and out-breathing. So this is how this sutta goes. And just to, by way of background, this sutta is found in many places in the Pali text. That's also found in across the various different texts in various languages, in Sanskrit and Chinese and everywhere. So it is one of the kind of foundational suttas as far as Buddhist meditation is concerned. And this is what the Buddha has to say. He says, "Bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. When the four applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven factors of awakening. When the seven awakening factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true insight and liberation." So this is the promise of Anapanasati, pretty strong promise there. So developed and cultivated means basically means that you fulfill the development of this breath meditation, take it all the way, take it as far as it goes. So it means being very serious about your meditation practice. And then the Buddha says it is of great fruit and great benefit. And this is one of the things that you find about the Buddha everywhere. He's kind of understated. He says, it's a great fruit and great benefit, and it doesn't sound all that special. But actually, when the Buddha says something is of great fruit and great benefit, it means like it is the absolutely top. It can't really go beyond that. If something is happiness, it is the maximum happiness, for example. So things in the suttas tend to be understated. The Buddha is not the sort of person who goes around and saying great and amazing and that sort of stuff and awesome. He doesn't say awesome to everything. He holds back on the superlatives a little bit. So this is what he's saying here. And of course, what is interesting about this is that breath meditation can take you all the way to awakening itself. True knowledge and deliverance, vijja vimutti. This refers to arahantship. It refers to insight into past lives, all of that. And deliverance or liberation, of course, means liberation from suffering first and foremost, but the liberation from the defilements of the mind and any kind of negative things, basically synonymous with achieving the highest happiness. And one of those important things to realize about the suttas is that often they can seem to focus on the negative qualities. We talk about the liberation from suffering and freedom from defilements and all of this. But the implication is always that the highest qualities, the highest positive qualities are developed at the same time. It's important to realize that, because the Buddhist suttas can seem very pessimistic if you just read the negative terms like that. And it seems like it's really kind of, wow, Buddhism is really here. And this is something you hear quite a lot, especially if someone tries to convince you that Buddhism is a bad idea. It's pessimistic. Come become a Christian instead. We're much more optimistic. You believe in God and bang, that's it. All you have to do. Easy and optimistic at the same time. Whereas you guys, you have to keep precepts, you have to meditate and all of this. So come this way instead. So if you don't have some feeling for what is truly going on, that argument might convince you. Yeah, it might actually think, yeah, maybe there's something to that. My father told me a story from many years ago when he was a businessman. He traveled a lot around Asia. And on one occasion, he was at a dinner somewhere because of some business deal or something like that. And there was a lady next to him. This was in Malaysia. So she was originally Chinese Malaysian, and she had been a Buddhist. Then she decided to become a Christian. And then my father asked her, "Why did you become a Christian? Why did you become a Christian?" And she said, "It's a much better deal." That's what she said, yeah? So much more easy. All you do is believe in God, and that's it. So it's a better deal. But be careful of those good deals. Yeah, sometimes the deals are too good to be true. And that is often part of the problem. So watch out for those dodgy car salesmen. Yeah, this is kind of this is the Buddhist version of the religious version of the dodgy car salesman that we sometimes have. So you fulfill everything. All of these good qualities are fulfilled simply by mindfulness of breathing, applications of mindfulness. You don't really have to go beyond anapanasati. You may wish to, and that's okay, but you don't. If you are happy with anapanasati, that is sufficient to actually fulfill these things. And in some ways, that's quite nice, because sometimes the way satipatthana can be explained can be very complicated. There can be so many different factors to it and various things that you have to do. So it can be nice to have a simple thing. So if you find that meditation works for you, then it's great to have a simple thing to focus on. And it takes you through the mindfulness meditation, and this sequence here shows you how these things work. So you practice the four foundations, the four applications of mindfulness. That helps you to abandon the last little remnant of defilements in the mind, the five hindrances. And then the opposite of the five hindrances, the inverse of that, are the seven factors of awakening. So as the four foundations or four applications of mindfulness are developed, the hindrances go down, then the positive qualities start to arise instead. This being the seven awakening factors. So all the joy and happiness and energy starts to arise. And eventually, if you keep on practicing that, and everything happens through the mindfulness of breathing, eventually it takes you all the way to vidya, true insight, and liberation, all the way. So it is quite a promise for this humble little breath. All you have to do is attend to the breath, with wisdom, of course, with insight and all of these things, but still, you can keep to one meditation object. So, let us see what this has to, how this actually works. This is how this teaching works out. And how, because is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? So the point here is that you have to follow these instructions, yeah, and then you can expect this to have great fruit and benefit. And if you don't follow these instructions fully, then you cannot expect the great fruit and benefit to be of the same greatness. It's going to be less, obviously. All of these factors that come now, they are important to make the meditation work properly. And as very often, it is the preliminary things that are sometimes the most important. What are the things that lead up to the mindfulness of breathing? And this little first paragraph that comes now, this is the kind of the precursor to actually the mindfulness of breathing. So in some ways, this is the most important thing. You get this right, because it's actually the hardest thing to get right. And once you get this right, then the mindfulness of breathing, as we shall see, is actually quite automatic. You just have to sit back and relax and enjoy it. And then it happens largely by itself, if you have the right attitude. So this is how the Buddha explains this. Here, a bhikkhu, or a mendicant perhaps, bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, layman, laywoman, anyone who does this practice, this is how you do it, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. So Here it starts off, first of all, the idea of a bhikkhu, just to remind you again, a bhikkhu doesn't mean that this is only to monks, it means that it is to anyone who is listening to the talk, which could be anyone who was present at the time. Gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. The idea here is that, again, this idea that meditation, if it's really going to have the full benefit, then it happens, it should really happen in solitude. Yeah, that's what you see here. Forest, root of a tree, empty hut. This is all about solitude. So this does not mean that meditation has no effect if you are not in solitude. It just means that it's not likely to go quite as deep, or it is less likely to go quite as deep unless you practice in complete solitude. So this is one of the reasons why also you come to a retreat center such as here, because you are kind of halfway house. Yeah, this is a fair amount of solitude, especially when you have noble silence and all of these things, and you have your own room. This is one of the great things about this retreat center. We didn't mess around with kind of having dormitories, that kind of stuff. This was Ajahn Brahm's idea. We have proper rooms. We build a meditation center for like the 21st century instead of building something that is not going to be all that useful. And this is one of the, I think, one of the really good things about this retreat center here. Another thing which is nice about this is that it is in the forest. Yeah, it's really nice. You sit here in the evening and you feel the peace and the stillness. It's actually very peaceful here. And it's difficult to find this sort of peace in a built-up area where there's more people around. So just experience that peace. And it's once you start to delight in that peace and that tranquility, then your mind also inclines towards a similar kind of internal peace. It's just a matter of delighting it and enjoying it. And when you do that, the inclination happens almost automatically as a consequence. So kind of the little things to learn to find happiness in spiritual values rather than the worldly values. And to do that, make that really deep and profound. So it happens in empty places, and it's this idea again that once you take your physical body, the kaya viveka, seclusion of the body, you take it out of the world, then the mind also tends to follow along afterwards. You have to give the mind a chance to calm down and to let go of all the worldly things, all the desires and all the problems in the world. And if you're always reminded of all the delightful things, worldly things, it's very difficult for the mind to let go and to focus on the spiritual aspects of life instead. So this is why seclusion is so useful. Kaya viveka leading to citta viveka. Seclusion of the body leading to seclusion of the mind. And again, this is also why the forest tradition is generally a good tradition where you can expect to get the best results in meditation practice, is for exactly the same reason. And there are forest traditions that are far more forest traditions than Bodhidharma Monastery is is nice, but you get much more forest tradition than that. People who live in absolute solitude far away in the forest. So that is and then the next thing here is that you sit down. Yeah, mindfulness of breathing is something that happens mostly in the sitting posture. It doesn't absolutely have to be in the sitting posture, but this is kind of the ideal thing here. And the reason for that is because one of them is that it is quite hard already to follow the breath sometimes. The breath is very subtle or can become very subtle. And unless you sit in a posture that is fairly refined, you're likely to lose the breath. In some traditions, they try to do breath meditation while doing walking meditation, and they claim to have success with that. Maybe it is possible. I haven't ever really tried it. Generally, the Buddha recommends the sitting posture so you have enough peace, enough stillness in the body to be able to follow the breath. Some people say you can do meditation while lying down, and it may be possible, but again, it can be tricky. Sitting up leads usually to more clarity of mind. You don't have this feeling that you're going to fall asleep, and this helps out. But you can sometimes, if you have pain in the body or problems in the body, you can try to lie down as well and see if that works for you. If you have good mindfulness, you may find it works out okay. There are people, really good meditators, who use the lying down posture, and they say that it is very beneficial for them. So you may try it out sometimes. But the main posture is sitting, and so sitting down is the ideal way of going about this. Then it says, having folded your legs crosswise, palanka is the Pali word for folding your legs crosswise. And this is according to the meditation, the way they did meditation, the way they probably often sat at that time in ancient India, was a natural way of sitting. They would often sit on the ground, not always, because there was furniture at that time too, but it was a fairly common thing. And often they were very comfortable sitting cross-legged. And if you get comfortable sitting cross-legged, great, because it actually is a very nice posture. It feels very nice when you sit cross-legged. I would recommend you to at least try it out, see if it works for you. But it's not a requirement. Yeah, it's not as if you have to give up meditation if you can't sit cross-legged. It's not quite like that. You can sit on a chair or you can sit against the wall. The most important thing is that you are at ease. The body is comfortable. You don't feel stressed out or have lots of pain. This is the most important thing, because that is very distracting for the meditation practice. That is more important. There are some suttas where there are people saying that, oh, I'm only comfortable if I sit cross-legged. And this gives you some idea that in ancient India, that was considered a comfortable position or posture. For most people these days, it's considered a terrible posture, really painful and really awkward. So you find that way that works for you. And you can change a bit, yeah? Sit a bit cross-legged, sit a bit on a chair, do various things, and find that way that works for you. So that is to find that kind of middle way there again, not be too attached to the literal word of the suttas in some of these cases. Some of these things are more important than other ones. Set your body erect. Yeah, and this is this feeling that when your body is straight, you have more clarity of the mind. If you are slouching, you can feel kind of the sloth and torpor being there. So having your body erect is useful. But again, try to allow it to happen quite naturally. Don't force yourself to sit straight if you don't feel like it. It's quite common. I know many people who start off with a meditation relaxing, leaning against the wall or something like that, sitting back and just allowing the mind to settle down. And then when the mind settles down and mindfulness starts to arise, it almost feels natural that you want to straighten up your body. So be wise about this. If you try to straighten up your body when you're really tired, you probably just lead to more stress and more problems as a consequence. So get things in the right order. It's okay just to kind of sit, lean back a little bit. It's perfectly acceptable, especially in the beginning. And then comes the most important part of all of these instructions, having established mindfulness in front of you, satting parimukkang upatapetva. And this is the most important part, because this is what enables you to watch the breath. And all of these other factors we have just been looking at, they are really also there to enable that mindfulness to arise. So you can be mindful when you come to the breath. And this is so important, because if you are mindful already when you start watching the breath, then watching the breath is fairly straightforward, because you're already in the present moment, the breath is here, and you're just aware of it, and it's no problem. The mind doesn't want to run off into the future or into the past, because the mindfulness has arisen, so it is the meditation happens fairly automatically. But if mindfulness has not been established, then the only way you're going to be able to watch the breath is by forcing your mind onto it, using willpower, using force. And often you hear people teaching breath meditation by counting the breath, and sometimes counting the breath forwards and then backwards. And if they still can't watch the breath, and they count it forwards up to 9, then backwards to 8, and forwards to 7, and backwards to 6, and they make it more and more complicated until it becomes so complex and so complicated that it's impossible. You're forcing your mind onto that through this incredibly complex way of watching the breath. And all of that, what it really does, it makes you use willpower, yeah? Because you have to kind of keep track of all these numbers. Actually, you're watching numbers, aren't you? Not really watching the breath anymore. Number watching. Maybe that's an alternative meditation technique, I wonder. Maybe, I don't know, I haven't tried that one. So, but the point I'm trying to make is simply that if you haven't got mindfulness, then the problem is that you will always have to use force to some one way or another. If you have mindfulness, then it will be quite automatic. So this is so important, and this is why I've spent quite a lot of time, especially on the first day, trying to show you how mindfulness arises. There's really two things that are important for mindfulness to arise. One of them is just to relax and allow things to be, to overcome your restless mind and your tired mind just by sitting back and waiting and kind of sleeping enough and all of that. And this is one of the important ways, especially in the beginning of a retreat or in daily life. This is very much what you have to do. And this is kind of the immediate thing here. And then, of course, the attitude that you have during meditation is very important, that you have a positive attitude, that you enjoy what you're doing. All of that is very supportive of meditation practice. But there is another thing which is even more important, and that is how you live your life. If you live your life well, if you consistently practice kindness and morality and all of these good things that we've talked about before, then when you come to the meditation, it's going to be, that's when you're going to have success in your meditation practice. The consistency in your moral behavior is really what matters. And remember that moral behavior in Buddhism is so broad. Basically, it refers to your entire character, it refers to all your habits, habits by body, speech and mind, and also your mental habits as well. So it's incredibly broad. It's much more than what we normally think of as morality in English. And it's not just, again, not just the avoidance of doing the bad things, but it's deliberately doing the good things. And it's only when you combine all of these things, three kinds of morality, body, speech and mind, doing good and avoiding the bad, when all of that comes together, that is when it really starts to have an effect on your inner life and how you feel about yourself and your ability to meditate later on. And this is like the long-term support for meditation practice. So this is what you have to do. And if you get all of these things together, then when you sit down, then mindfulness arises. Again, why does mindfulness arise in this case? And the reason is because if you live a moral life, it means you generally feel good about yourself, and you feel good about yourself in the present moment. So it's easy, much more easy to stay in the present moment rather than if you have regrets or you have feel that you did something bad, you don't feel good about yourself, the mind wants to move off into fantasies, the future, the past or whatever. But if you feel good about yourself, then the present moment becomes quite nice and it's more easy to stay here. The second reason is because with the mental defilements, they are all about craving, a lot of them, or they can be about ill will. And these are forces of the mind that by the very definition take you out of the present moment. Desires, ill wills are always about, desires and cravings are always about the future. Not always, they can be about the past, but they're often about the future. Ill will is often about things that happened in the past, things that you are upset about. So by letting go of those things, by living well, you're actually allowing the mind to settle in the present moment. You get rid of this abhijja domanasa, vinaya loki abhijja domanasa, as it says at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is why, how this works, and why it is so powerful, and why it then gives you access to this mindfulness. And then another little trick is this idea of right view we had a look at before, the idea of thinking about the world in the right way, because that makes the world much less interesting. It makes the spiritual path interesting. And when that is the case, there is much less likelihood that your mind will stay with all the worldly things, because basically they are not as relevant for your happiness, your meaning, and everything that actually matters in life. So that is the idea of establishing mindfulness. in front of him, parimukha. This is a word which is often debated, what that actually means, and there's different understandings of this. And this is where you get these ideas in Buddhism. Depending on which kind of teaching you listen to, you will be told to focus on the breath on the upper lip or the tip of the nose, or sometimes it will be said about you feel it in the stomach or the belly region. Parimukha never means belly, that's absolutely sure. Cannot mean belly, that's, everybody agrees with that, but still they say they should focus on the belly, which is okay, it doesn't matter that much. So what does it actually mean? And there isn't any very strong evidence one way or the other, but the argument for those who have studied this in more detail, at least some of them, is that parimukha just means in front of you, in the present space, right here and now, something like that. And I think that is, for me, that makes good sense. The commentaries say it means the upper lip or the tip of the nose. Maybe it can mean that as well. Maybe it can mean both of those things at the same time. It doesn't matter all that much. I have always followed the way Ajahn Brahm teaches breath meditation, which is just to know whether the breath goes in or out. You don't focus any particular place on the body. You just know the breath goes in, you know the breath goes out. Actually, where it is on the body is irrelevant. What you find out is that sometimes when you get peaceful, you find out that actually you have been watching it at the tip of the nose all along anyway. This is why I said it can be both. You can have both meanings, and it may be that both meanings are intended. I'm not sure about that. But don't worry too much about that. The main important point here is just your ability to know whether the breath is going in, if the breath is going out. If you know that, then you are doing breath meditation here. Parimukha here. It's important not to get too bogged down in these little things, because you might think that this is absolutely essential to know what parimukha means before you can do breath meditation. And if you think that that is absolutely essential, you probably never get started with doing any meditation at all, because it's just impossible sometimes to find out exactly what it means. So sometimes you just have to kind of let it be. So parimukha doesn't matter that much. I'm sure that you feel really relieved now, is that right? That you don't have to know exact meaning of parimukha. You may never have heard the word before. Some of you who have been around, you would have heard the word before, because it's kind of important for meditation practice. Anyway, so next one. Ever mindful you breathe in, ever mindful you breathe out. So once you have established mindfulness, that comes first. Only then are you mindful of your breath. That is when the breath meditation starts. Yeah? Get these things in the right sequence. When you get them in the right sequence, then they will really work and they will become a powerful meditation technique. So mindful you breathe in, mindful you breathe out. There's an interesting little word there, the word ever. You may have noticed the word ever. Pali word is eva, actually very similar to ever when you think about it. Ever and eva, almost the same, except that you have an A on the end. But I think that's just a coincidence. I don't think they have anything to do with each other. But the word eva does not necessarily mean ever. The word eva can have two meanings, and one of them is like ever, in other words, always, yeah. And another one is more like just or only, is the other meaning of eva. So it is, in this case, it actually is a bit interesting what it means, because ever mindful sort of implies that you are mindful at all the time. Yeah, there is no gap in your mindfulness. But we're still just starting out. We have just given rise to mindfulness. It is unlikely that the mindfulness is incredibly strong at this particular time. So the word ever is a bit suspicious in this particular context when you start out. But the word only or just mindful actually makes quite good sense. And the idea here is that you are just mindful of the breath. You don't try to use willpower to manipulate the breath, to make it. We'll see in a second that it starts out with watching the long breath and the short breath. It does not mean that you manipulate the breath to be long or short. There are many people who do that. There's quite, sometimes you get taught meditation practice and you're told to manipulate the breath, make it short, make it long. Yeah, but that little word eva, I think, is really the one that should guard you against that. It is not about manipulating. It is about allowing things to be. And And that actually is very nice. Remember, when you come back to that sutta I mentioned very early on, where it says that the meditation practice is dhammata, it is according to nature. Yeah, it happens according to natural phenomena. It is not something that you can do by willpower, na chetanaya karaniya, not to be done using the will. Well, if it is not to be done using the will, then it does not make sense that you should actually make the breath long or short in this particular case. It makes sense that rather you should stand back and largely allow the breath to be as it actually is. So a small little word like that can actually make a big difference. So this shouldn't really be much willpower here. You should put aside willpower really as much as you can. There may still be a little bit of will left. Actually, it's very likely to be a little bit of will left at this particular stage. And the reason is because to be able to watch the breath, you have to want to watch the breath. This is what this is about. You have to have some chanda. We will see later on how the word chanda is used in the suttas in the early stages of samadhi or samatha meditation. That is part of the iddhipadas. And that chanda is still likely to be present at this particular stage. It's only when you get deeper in the meditation, when the joy and the happiness starts to arise, and the meditation becomes incredibly powerful, where it is completely self-sustaining. It is completely self-sustaining because it is such a wonderful thing, you don't want to do anything else. But at this stage, it's not that bright yet, not that beautiful yet, that you need a little bit of inclination towards this. But you can put aside the vast majority of the normal doing and willing and just leave enough just to hang out with the breath. It almost feels as if you're doing nothing at all. Sometimes it feels as if you're doing nothing at all. There's a slight inclination left there, the chanda that just makes you stay with the breath at this particular point. Okay, so that is the background. And then we come to the actual meditation itself. And you will notice here that this is divided up into four paragraphs. And each of these four paragraphs has four individual items in it. And each of these paragraphs, each one of them that has four items in it, is equivalent to one of the four Satipatthanas in the Satipatthana Sutta. So the Satipatthana Sutta, as I mentioned the other day, this is the sutta on the mindfulness meditation, or the applications of mindfulness. There's four ways or four objects that you have when you do that. Body, feelings, vedana, or sensations if you like, citta, which is mind, and dhamma, which is principles, or maybe mind objects being the last one. These are the four Satipatthanas. And each one of these here is equivalent to one of those four. And as we go through this, I'll show you how that works. That is a useful thing to keep in mind. So the first one then is about equivalent to body contemplation. And this is how it reads. Breathing in long, you understand, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, you understand, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you understand, I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, you understand, I breathe out short. You train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. You train thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. You train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So there you are. So some of this is very obvious. Some of it is not so obvious. I don't know what you feel about bodily formation, whether you straight away know what that means. I'd be very impressed if you do, unless you have come to these retreats before. But bodily formation to me is one of these very obscure terms that makes it very hard to understand what is going on. And I think Bhante Sujato and even Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in his latest translation, he doesn't have that. He has tranquilizing the bodily activity instead of the bodily formation. And the reason he has that is because he changed from formation to activity. The word is sankhara, and you can thank me for the fact that he did that. Because I wrote to him and I said, get rid of formations. I don't want to. Formation is completely incomprehensible. Try activity or something instead. And he said, okay, well, let's try activity here. And he did that. I was very pleased with myself when he came around on that one here. So anyway, so that makes it more comprehensible. But let's start from the top. So breathing in long, you understand that you breathe in long. So this just means being aware of the breath. Yeah, you just know that the breath is long, you know that the breath is short, is the next one, whatever it is. It just means that you have awareness of the breath, of what is happening. That's really all it means. And you understand you breathe out long here. Yeah, so same thing, in and out. And then breathe in short, same thing again. You know that whether you're breathing in or out, short. Why is there this difference between long and short? And one of the reasons is that I think it's quite common to experience that once you have relaxed and you're mindful, the breath becomes quite long. Yeah, it becomes relaxed. But then as your mindfulness sharpens, the breath sometimes becomes a bit shorter, as if you need less oxygen, or I'm not sure exactly what is going on, but the breath kind of calms down and becomes shorter. That may be one of the reasons why it is like that. Or it may simply be the fact that you have awareness of the breath, so you know the different qualities of the breath. But it may be that there is a natural movement here from one to the other one. So once mindfulness is established, it is natural that you know the breath. You don't have to do anything more. You are just aware of the breath, long and short. But then we come to the third one, which is you train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. You will notice here there is a change from understands to trains. Yeah, understanding is pajanati, trains is sikkhati, I think. Why is there that difference? What does it mean to train in this particular context? And what it means is that when you are refining your attention, you're making your mindfulness more powerful so you can see the whole breath that is talked about here, it takes a while for the mind to settle down. It takes training, it takes time. You don't train in the sense that you use willpower or you force yourself to do this. You train yourself by giving yourself enough time to allow this to happen. It is, again, a fairly natural process. There may be some desire there to stay with the breath, but it's a very weak desire at the back of your mind. But more and more, you just allow the process to happen by itself. And then, as you do that, that is what the training is, just standing back and allowing it to happen, really. Maybe inclining the mind a little bit, sometimes nudging the mind a little bit, just reminding it of what is important or whatever, and very gentle things that you do, and then it kind of goes into this process. So what we are seeing here is an expansion of the mindfulness, seeing more and more of what is going on. First of all you know is that the breath is, you know, only know the breath, one breath at a time, but now you experience the breath in much more detail. That is what is meant by the whole body of the breath. Sabba kaya patisangvedi is the Pali. What is this? It's actually quite interesting. Sabba kaya patisangvedi, because kaya, the word kaya in Pali, very often it can mean the physical body. And this is why, for this reason, that sabba kaya patisangvedi is very often or sometimes translated as experiencing the whole body. Patisangvedi means to experience. Sabba is all, kaya is body. Experiencing the whole body is often a translation. And if you go to certain meditation traditions, that is how they interpret it. So according to those traditions, you start off watching the breath, then you start feeling the whole body, and then you go back to the breath again. This is how they do it. So is that correct? Does it matter? What is the alternative explanation? And the alternative explanation, and you will see that here, it has of the breath in parentheses. I don't know what you feel when you see the parentheses, whether you feel a bit, you know, this is a bit dodgy. Yeah, why is the parentheses here? It feels a bit dodgy, doesn't it? It feels like it has someone kind of added some random stuff into the suttas. This kind of makes you question things when you see little parentheses like that. But in this case, I think it is probably very good to have the parentheses, because it adds something that otherwise would be very hard to see. And that is, according to the commentary, sabba kaya refers to the whole breath body, the whole body of the breath. And I personally think that is the correct interpretation of the sutta for many reasons. One reason is that kaya in the suttas does not always mean physical body. Sometimes it just means a group of related phenomena, like all breaths form the kaya of breaths, the body of all breaths. Just like the word body in English can mean a group of things, like a body of evidence or a corporate body or something like that, in exactly the same way, and actually even more so in Pali, kaya can just mean a heap of things. The root word, root meaning of kaya, from chi, the root chi, means a heap. And I think that is what kaya also means. It means a heap. It means a heap of phenomena coming together. And it actually says specifically in the Anapanasati Sutta, it's actually after the part that I have given here. It's quite a long sutta. And it carries on and it says specifically that the breath is one body among bodies. Yeah, it specifically says this is one type of phenomena among many other types of phenomena. So to me, it is fairly, I feel it is fairly obvious that it must refer to the breath. And also we are doing breath meditation. It makes sense that it should be about the breath. So I understand this to mean the breath. But this is, you can see now why sometimes there is disagreements, yeah? Why sometimes there is arguments, and you can spend your whole life arguing about whether this means the whole body of the breath or the whole physical body. And of course, if you spend your whole life doing that, then you, when you get reborn in the next life, you continue arguing in the next life. And on it goes. And this is why you get reborn, because you argue about the breath rather than watching the breath. And this is, it becomes a problem. So the question then is, does it really matter which way we do it? And I would say, actually, it probably doesn't matter all that much. It doesn't matter all that much, because as long as you come back to the breath again later on, even if you want to do a little bit of excursion into the whole physical body, as long as you come back, and as long as the general process is the same, that you become more peaceful, that you become more calm, as long as you follow the general progress, actually, it doesn't matter that much. So sometimes we just need to put aside these arguments and just go with common sense and just see if it works. And as long as it works, that's really the important issue here. Some of these things are not that important. Anyway, so the main point here is that your mindfulness is expanding. You are seeing more, whether it's of the physical body or the breath. I would say the breath is, to me, it is the only sensible explanation here, but other people will disagree here. So you train. It takes time before this actually happens, and that's why you train in this particular way here. Then you have, the next one is you train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation, or if you like, the bodily activity. If it is the bodily activity, it becomes quite clear what is meant, yeah? Bodily activity is any motion that is in the body. And what is the main motion in the body when you're watching the breath? Well, it is the breath itself that is the main motion in the body. So the bodily activity or bodily formation here, which is the kaya sankhara, again, sankhara having very broad meaning. It means like activity in many situations, like the chaitana, the will, the activity of the mind, and referring also to the activity of the body or the activity of speech inside. And it is defined elsewhere in the sutta, just to make it absolutely clear, it is defined elsewhere as the breath. So what we're doing here is that you are tranquilizing the breath. Yeah, you can see how this works stage by stage, becoming more and more subtle as you go along. The long breath, you calm down. The short breath, as you calm down more, the awareness expands. You see the whole breath, and then also you tranquilize the breath. The breath becomes more and more peaceful, more and more tranquil as you go along here. And all of this, really, ideally, is a very automatic process. Things happen because you are just allowing it to happen. You're not getting involved. And as this process happens, actually, your involvement is decreasing all the time. Less and less involved. More and more standing back. Less and less chanda or desire or wanting. And just allowing things to be as you go through this. Tranquilizing the breath. Sometimes the breath gets so tranquil that people lose it altogether, it disappears. And that's a common, quite a common experience. What do you do when your breath disappears? Do you die? Maybe, I don't know. I do die. Of course you don't die. People sometimes think, oh, I think I'm going to die, yeah, because my breath is gone. But of course, it's not the breath that is gone. It is your ability to watch the breath that has disappeared. The body is fully capable of looking after itself. You don't have to make it breathe or force it to breathe. Otherwise, you would die while you slept every night. Maybe we do. Maybe we just wake up in the morning, it's a different life. Maybe that's what it is. I don't think so. So it is a natural thing for the body just to be able to breathe by itself. You don't have to worry about it. So what shall we do when the breath disappears? And really, all you have to do is just sit back and just wait. Yeah, enjoy what is happening, enjoy the peace. It is often very peaceful at this particular moment in the meditation practice. And you can just enjoy what is happening already. Maybe mindfulness is not sharp enough. Maybe there's a bit of the mind is a bit dull or something like that. That's why you can't see the breath or something like that. It's hard to really know exactly what might be happening. But just allow it to be. And when you allow it to be, one of two things tend to happen. If you are able to enjoy, just enjoy the peace, and there are some people who do that, all they do is focus on the peace and enjoy that, and they don't even hardly watch the breath at all. And what happens is that it actually develops and becomes more powerful, and then you move on to the next stage of this process all by itself. Yeah, it kind of moves on. You start to feel delight arising, happiness arising. Maybe you even nudge the mind a little bit towards some kind of nice recollection that gives rise to the joy, the peace, and all of these kind of things. And then the process carries on from there. That is one thing that happens, but perhaps more commonly what happens is that if you just allow it to be, is that after a while the breath comes back again. It doesn't take that long, and then the breath becomes more coarse. And then when the breath becomes more coarse, then you are able to stay with it again, and then you can continue with the breath meditation from that point. Those are really the two things that are going to happen. But no need to worry about dying. Yeah, you should be perfectly safe from that. It's just a matter of having the confidence that the body will look after itself when you get to this particular point. So that is the kaya nusati. This is kaya nupassana. This is the breath, because the breath is one body among bodies. When you do the breath meditation this way, you are fulfilling the first part of the Satipatthana Sutta, the contemplation of the body. Kaya nupassi. That's all you have to do. So let us go on. Might as well go on to the next one. And the next four stages of the Anapanasati Sutta, this relates to the mindfulness of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta. They are equivalent to that. So let us have a look at this one. So you train. Thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture. This is piti. You train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture. You train thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure. You train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure. You train thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mental formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation. You train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. So here you can see we are getting into a feeling territory. Rapture is like joy, yeah? And then you have pleasure, which is sukha, we often translate it as happiness. These are feelings that can be either physical or mental, or usually a bit of both, and they're very beautiful feelings when these things start to arise in your meditation practice. Then you have the mental formation. This is just more feeling, really. It's just the same way of saying what you have said before, but just perhaps a little bit more refined. Bhante-Sujato has emotion there as a translation, which I think is much more evocative and much better than mental formation, more useful. And You could also translate it perhaps as a mental activity. It is what goes on in the mind. Yeah, what is happening in the mind. And what is that happens in the mind? Well, what happens in the mind at this point is feelings. You're experiencing these feelings. And they will often come with a certain perception as well. So citta sankhara is often defined in the sutta as feeling and perception. Because this is the activity going on at this point. There's very little willpower going on. The will is largely subsided already, maybe a little bit at the background. So it's quite a peaceful experience already. And then the last one is also about this mental formation. So this is all about feeling, yeah? And this is why this is equivalent to the Vedana Anupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta. But what is interesting about this is that you will notice there is also some difference. If you read the Vedana Anupassana, the contemplation of feeling of the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about all kinds of different kinds of feelings. It talks about the niramisa feelings and the samisa feelings. And niramisa means, amisa in Pali is a word that really means like flesh. Niramisa means like, or carnal. We can probably maybe translate it as carnal because it's a kind of a evocative word. So you have the a non-carnal happiness or the spiritual happiness and suffering or whatever. And then you have the carnal happiness, which is like the worldly happiness that comes from worldly things. And in the Satipatthana Sutta, these things are especially pointed out. Yeah, so you have both the dukkha vedana and the happy vedana, the happy feeling, and then the neutral feeling in relation to both the carnal and the spiritual, the worldly, if you like, and the spiritual. So there it is very broad. It talks especially about knowing the suffering and the pain, etc. So for that reason, it is quite common for meditators to focus on the pain in the body, for example, because it seems to be implied in the Satipatthana Sutta that you should do that. But if you look here at the Satipatthana Sutta, actually you don't have to contemplate the feelings, the painful feelings at all. Isn't that nice? Yeah, there's no need to actually focus on the painful feelings. You can bypass them entirely and still you can fulfill and complete the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings in the Satipatthana Sutta through a practice that only focuses on pleasant feelings. It's good news, isn't it? Yeah, and this is what is so wonderful about this path is that you don't actually have to go through much suffering at all. Of course, there's always going to be some suffering. It's impossible to have a life without suffering. It's impossible to have come here to Dharma Grove and have just bliss altogether for 9 days. May not be absolutely impossible, but it's pretty much close to impossible unless you're an arahant and you can kind of go into some very profound states of meditation. It is virtually impossible. But what it means is that you don't have to create these painful feelings in order to contemplate them. You can actually leave them out altogether and just focus on happy feelings. How then can you understand the painful feelings if you don't watch them? And this is one of the kind of very interesting things to understand about insight on the Buddhist path. You don't have to watch something to understand it. You can understand things by their absence. In fact, the understanding that comes from something's absence is far more powerful than the understanding that comes from just observing it directly. When something is absent, you have full understanding of what it is about. If painful feelings are completely gone, and how do you feel when they're completely gone? Well, first of all, you know that they are anicca, impermanent, in the most profound sense possible, because they can disappear completely. So you know everything you really need to know about those painful feelings. They are completely anicca. You don't need them. You can live without them, and that's perfectly okay. Of course, you know that painful feelings are suffering. You don't really need to, you know, that's pretty obvious. Yeah, that's kind of that's too obvious. You see that straight away. And you see that very clearly when they disappear. That is when you understand how much suffering they actually are. Yeah? The more happiness and joy and all of these good feelings you have in your meditation, the more problematic you understand the body actually is, because it's so full of painful feelings. When we are used to the body all the time, we don't understand how much pain and trouble there is in the physical body. Only when you enter profound samadhi do you really understand that. You understand it because for the first time they're completely absent. And when they are completely absent, wow, what joy to have these things completely gone. And then the last thing you understand is that they are non-self, because when they're completely gone, well, you are still there. You can't even access them sometimes, so they must be non-self, because you have no access to these feelings. Something which is a self is something that by definition you have access to. Yeah, the Buddha says, let it be this way, let it be that way, in the Anattalakkhana Sutta. Don't have access to it. It is, by definition, non-self. So you can understand things, in fact, much better by their absence than by observing it directly. No need to observe the painful feelings. Bypass the painful feelings altogether. Go straight to the happy feelings. It makes for a far more satisfactory path, much more enjoyable, and also it actually leads to more profound insights than observing these things directly. That is what I would recommend. And this is really how the Buddha teaches this right here. He just leaves out the painful feelings entirely. And this is one of those things that you find the more you study the path of the Buddha, the more you see it focuses on happiness all the way through. Happy, pleasant feelings. And this may come as news to people because we always talk about dukkha, the first noble truth, and it all sounds like it's focused on pain. But actually, when you read the path itself focuses on happy feelings almost exclusively throughout, and you can bypass the pain. The reason why we focus on dukkha in the first noble truth is that because in the really big picture of things, things are dukkha. But from a personal perspective, when you meditate, it's happiness. It's a different perspective on seeing the same thing. Yeah? So this is one of those great little insights that you have when you start reading the suttas. The focus on happiness in these teachings is actually very large and very great. Okay, so let's just finish off this Vedananupassana, the second section here. So, actually maybe not, because it's pretty much 4 o'clock already and it will take a little bit of time to do this. Maybe we should stop there. Otherwise, I don't want to hurry through this, because this is one of the most important teachings on meditation altogether, so it's good to have enough time to do it properly. So let's just stop there. And then we'll see you back again at 7:30 this evening here.